Welcome to The Word at Westminster, a podcast with talks, studies, interviews, sermons, and more from Westminster Church in Barrie, Canada. It's about learning and living God's Word. Welcome, everybody, to this episode. I'm really excited to be speaking with Greg Kokel about apologetics, basic building blocks to faith. And before we get into our conversation, let me just introduce him to you for the few of you who may not know much about him. So he holds MA degrees in both apologetics and philosophy. He's spoken on over 50 university campuses, hosted his own radio talk show for over 19 years, I believe, defending Christianity worth thinking about. He's the founder and president of Stand to Reason and serves as adjunct professor of Christian apologetics at Biola University. One of his books is called Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions, and I'll reference that frequently about throughout today's talk. This is what really got me interested in him and in his work and got me directed to his website and his podcast. William Craig Lane says about it, "Tactics will make you a more effective ambassador for Christ." In the foreword of the book, Lee Strobel, author of the best-selling book, The Case for Christ, that many of us know, says, "We live in a day when militant atheism is on the march. Let Greg be your mentor as you master new approaches to talking with others about Jesus. As Greg likes to say, you don't need to hit home runs. You don't even need to get on base. Just getting up to bat, engaging others in friendly conversation will do." I love that. So thank you so much, Greg, for taking time to be with us today. Sure. Can you tell us a bit about apologetics, what that is for those who are fairly new to all this?
Well, it's an awkward word in the 21st century because we think of it as apologizing in the contemporary use of that word, but it used to mean to make a defense. And the famous passage in the New Testament, 1 Peter 3:16, it says we should always be ready to give an answer to make a defense. And that Greek word is apologia. So from that word comes this broader discipline of apologetics. One of my friends calls it just case making. Mm-hmm. He's a former cop, J. Warner Wallace. You may know who he is, but yeah. Case making, that is making the case for Christianity, answering challenges to Christianity, and then giving positive evidences for Christianity. So that's really all it amounts to. It's in fact, the word itself isn't a particularly religious word, although that's where it's usually used. Richard Dawkins is an apologist, for example, for atheism, mm-hmm. and for Darwinian evolution. And so that word has a broad application, but it's generally associated with Christian defenses.
Mm-hmm. So you referenced that passage from the New Testament, 1 Peter 3:15, which is a very, very well known, in apologetic circles. Obviously, it's one of the huge verses. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And you just referenced that. Right. But do this with gentleness and respect. So just let me ask you out of the gate, just to be personal here. So what is your reason for the hope that you have?
Well, there are different ways to approach that. I mean, the hope that I have is that I have been rescued by Jesus. And he has rescued me from the guilt of my sin, from the punishment of my sin. He's made me a member of God's forever family, and I have a future. And when I talk about future, I mean like an eternal future. So mm-hmm. It's not just this 40 and 10, whatever that happens to be. And sometimes in this life, it's not very nice. And this is why we're constantly encouraged that regardless of what happens, as Paul says in Romans chapter 8, I do not count the sufferings of this life to be any comparison to the glory that is to follow. 2 Corinthians, mm-hmm. he says, for the momentary light affliction, which seems like a real dismissal of his own sufferings when he explains it later in the book of 2 Corinthians. He went through a lot of hardship, but their momentary light compared to the eternal weight of glory. And what's interesting is he says it's the momentary light afflictions that are producing. It's the root to this glory that we will receive when we follow. So that's my hope. That's what I hope in. I don't hope in everything being just so in this life, because that's not the promise. Well, unfortunately, a lot of Christians put their focus there. Mm-hmm. My hope is in ultimate and eternal rescue. All right. Mm-hmm. So what are the reasons I have for that? Well, the biggest reason, lots of ways to approach this as someone who makes a case for the Christian worldview and Christianity and the existence of God and all that. Probably the central feature is Jesus. And if you want to simplify this, the reason for my hope is Jesus, because Jesus is the one who rescued me. Now, who is this Jesus? Well, he's the one who's recorded in the primary source historical documents that we know as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, notice I didn't say the Bible says. And the reason is that though those books are in the Bible, when we just make reference to it as the Bible, it's easy for people to just dismiss it for a whole host of reasons. But historians don't do that with those four books. They treat them as history. Now, and for good reason, because they have all the marks of good history. Now, that doesn't mean they believe everything in there, because there's the kind of history that they're not comfortable with philosophically, which includes, you know, miracles and resurrections and healings and God and that kind of stuff. So they may be agnostic about that or reject that part of it. But the point I'm making is we have an historical record. And the kinds of things that the historians agree on across the board about the historical record allow us to move very confidently towards the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth actually rose from the dead, okay? And I make actually the case for this in a different book I wrote called The Story of Reality, but the point here is I have confidence in my hope because Jesus lived and died and rose again. And we have means at our disposal to demonstrate that that actually happened in history. It was so real that if you were there at that cross on that Friday and you put your hand against it, you would have gotten a splinter in it. The blood flowing down from the person on the cross would have had a blood type. If you were there at the tomb 2 days later, you would have to duck for the blast power, so to speak, of the resurrection as that stone was rolled away and Jesus came out with such force that all of the soldiers there dropped over as if dead. So what I'm talking about here is a genuine historical event. Mm-hmm. And so as a Christian, I am not putting my faith by a leap in a fantasy or a story or a fairy tale or a once upon a time thing. I'm putting it in a fact of history that changed the world and is the basis for changing my life. Now, by the way, that is being contended, and this is one of the things that we contend for in careful ways as apologists. But as for my hope is in Jesus because he rescued me, and I have good reason to believe that he actually did the things that accomplished that.
Mm-hmm. When you were speaking about that, it brought to mind something else that you say in the book about, you know, you talked about, you know, referencing the four gospels and specific historical things that happened and how details matter and how quite often when people will say things, they might throw these kind of vague generalities at you, which kind of go out there and we can contest them, but details are a great way to undermine that. An example I found in preparation for this, just, you know, just about that point, in the Encyclopedia of Wars, it documents, you know, this is against the argument that, oh, well, you know, all, you know, religions just cause wars and all the world's wars
are
because of this.
The greatest cause of war.
The greatest cause of wars
in the world. Right. Yeah.
So by this accounting, you know, documents, you know, 1763 wars between 8000 BC and 2003 AD, 7% were marked as religious. And even that is debatable, you know, just because someone stands at the front of an army and holds up a sword and says for the Lord, that doesn't mean it's religious conflict. But idea that actually details, oh, actually, here's what the facts are, can really kind of cut away at some of the things. But at the same time, when you're explaining your faith and you provide specific details, it sounds more real because it is real.
Yeah, that's a tactic in the book called Just the Facts, Ma'am. And a lot of objections against Christianity are based on misunderstandings of facts and quantifiable, easy to show. And this, you might have been reading from the footnotes in the book because I do use that reference there to make that particular case. And so that's one way of dealing with objections. They just get the facts wrong.
Yeah. So what I found is a lot of people in my own context and just as a pastor and as a writer, or just in my own friend circles, aren't very confident in talking about or defending their faith. And we live in a time, I think, that is increasingly hostile to Christianity, at least to historic biblical Christianity.
Sure.
Especially here in Canada. Yeah. So to someone who experiences that uncertainty and hostility, but who wants to become more confident in speaking about their faith, what should that first step be for them?
Well, I'm going to suggest two steps, and one is a kind of a psychological step, and the other one's a practical step. although the psychological one has practical applications. In light of the increasing hostility that there is in our both of our respective cultures on both sides of the border, well, harder for you guys than for us, but we're working hard to catch up with you, unfortunately. My response is, get used to it. Accept it as a fact of life now. Now, for the last 2,000 years, in most of the parts of the world, even now, Christians have had it pretty bad. There's been some time when they've had hegemony in some areas, but certainly in the United States for the last 200 years. But most Christians have had to suffer. And this is clear in the scriptures. You know, First Peter is all about, is written to suffering Christians. So was Hebrews. So was First Thessalonians. So was Second Thessalonians. So was Philippians. You know, so, you know, you've got all of this in there. And we have kind of dodged the bullet for a long time. And so when it starts happening to us in very mild ways, we think, oh my gosh, you know, what am I going to do? The world's coming to the end, you know, Chicken Little kind of stuff. When we realize, if we look historically and biblically, this is kind of the thing we should expect. You might even read Matthew 10, where Jesus is sending out his disciples in their first missionary journey there, that short-term deal. It's interesting. He talks about the problems, and then he says, do not fear them, three times inside of about six or seven verses. And he gives a different rationale each time, but he's telling them not to fear. Are they going to encounter heavy-duty stuff? Of course. He says that there. He acknowledges that. But he says, do not fear them. So I would encourage people to say, just make your peace with the fact that if you are going to be a faithful Christian, a real Christian, then you are not going to be at peace with most of the world for most of your life. Okay? Just accept that. And when I remember William Lane Craig, who you mentioned a few moments ago, he was asked this question about receiving hostility because he's debated so many atheists. He said, how do you deal with the hostility? He said, I rejoice, because that's what Jesus said to do in Matthew 5. Rejoice. Your reward in heaven is great. You can check that out. There's more that he has to say about that in Matthew 5. But the second thing, though, is if you're not confident, then it's possible to get confident. And getting confident isn't kind of like screwing up more faith. And unfortunately, this is the way most churches and church staffs and pastors kind of deal with the challenges from outside. Instead of dealing with them, they just tell Christians, read your Bible more, pray more, have more faith, and quit asking those questions that we can't answer. And this is a deadly combination. All right. Of course, it's fine to pray more and read your Bible more, but these folks need answers. And this is why organizations like Stand to Reason exist. And where some congregations have good pastors like you that also understand the importance of providing a reason for the hope that's within us. And I'll tell you something. We have a very, very deep bench. What I mean is there are hundreds and hundreds of contemporary Christians, not just historically, who have done all the hard work to answer all the hard challenges that are being raised. And it's now available like never before on the internet, but there's books, et cetera, that will help as well. So there is no reason not to get confident. I realize everybody's life is hard and everybody's got schedules and they have this and that and the other thing, you know, and I got to run to the school and pick up my daughter and take her to volleyball practice for myself later this afternoon, okay? But I still need to do the really important things because, you know, when our lives are over, volleyball's gone, okay? But there is an eternity ahead of us that we need to prepare for. And so there's a pecking order of importance. And I think one of these is, as Christians are facing more hostility, as you pointed out, we need to get more confident by building our confidence with the information that's available to show us that our views are actually true.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you. Yeah, it's almost like we need to fall out of love with fitting in. which we've done for quite a period of time.
Good way to put it. Sounds like a nice pastorism there. Use that one in sermons. That's good.
That, but also, you know, there are practical things you can do. Take steps to build confidence. And that's so much of what your book helps us. But also even just knowing that, because I think some people feel that like, well, if I dig in to find some answers, or I look into this issue, or I, you know, what do people say about the problem of evil, for example, that evil exists? They think, oh, I'm not going to like what I find. But actually, you know, your comment about the deep bench is very helpful. There's a lot of great, you know, wisdom through the, and there's nothing to fear in that as well.
In fact, on that particular question, though, it has a lot of different aspects to it. Broadly, the problem of evil, that is, that there is real evil in the world, turns out to be one of the best arguments for God, not against God. It's classically known as the moral argument, and I developed that in more in the Story of Reality, but I probably touch on that in the Tactics book.
Yeah, you do.
So, and this is a surprise for some people. The problem that they feared the most, that they didn't know how to answer, turns out when they see how it fits in the broader worldview structure, turns out to be a great evidence in favor of Christianity and not against Christianity.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of the short version of it is that the fact that we identify, okay, there is such a thing as evil. Well, how do we know? Well, there has to be some sort of moral compass by which we judge it. And if we're ever going to say something that, oh, that's evil, well, based on what? Why are we giving that reason? Sure. So what you'd say kind of the short answer of leading us back to why there must be this, you know, maker of morality.
Sure, exactly. There's got to be a scoring system, to put it simply, and that's your moral compass. But scoring systems don't just appear out of thin air. If they did, what would create an obligation for us to obey that system if it just appeared out of thin air? Morality is obligation, and obligation is held between persons. And if there are laws that we break, then they must have come from a lawbreaker. And since our question is about the problem of evil writ large, evil out there, not just things we don't like, which would be more relativism, then we have to account for the laws that are broken based on these are transcendent laws. There has to be a transcendent lawmaker, a person to whom we're obliged. And so that is the thumbnail sketch of the moral argument.
So in your book, you talk about obviously being prepared to give an answer, but you talk about some other key things that Christians should be prepared to explain or defend. So could you just mention to us what are they?
You know, I read that question coming in, and I a lot of times authors forget the details of their book, so I wasn't entirely sure the specific things you're making reference to, but I have mentioned the resurrection of Christ, and you know, in the history of God's people in the Old Testament and God's people in the New Testament, there are two massive historical events that really ground everything else, and that was the parting of the Red Sea and the rescue from Egypt, and all the signs that associated with that. And in the New Testament, it is the resurrection. And interestingly, in both systems, the people during that time and this time, the writers are referring back to those events as being the core events. And so the resurrection of Christ is absolutely vital, so much so that Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 says that, I mean, quite frankly, he says, if the resurrection has not actually happened, people should feel sorry for Christians. Mm-hmm. His exact words were, we have most people should be pitied, you know.
Yeah.
But Christ has raised from the dead. So that shows the significance, the importance of it theologically and to our convictions. Of course, the question of God's existence is huge. When I talked earlier, I started with Jesus in the Gospels and the resurrection. That's in apologetic circles, that's called the one-step method. The classical method is to start with the existence of God and move from God outward. And but the issue of God's existence is still really critical. And in fact, I'm convinced that this particular question, does God exist, is the biggest question of all. And so, because so much follows from that, if there is no God, let me back up for a moment. Worldviews entail certain things, okay? So if you believe in governments, you're going to believe in laws, and then you're going to believe in punishment for breaking those laws, and you're going to believe in, that's how governments work. And then you got to fund the government, and there are all kinds of things. government over the people that are entailed underneath the big concept. Well, this is true of worldviews as well. Mm-hmm. And so if there is a God, the kind of God that we talk about in Christianity,
right?
Well, he's in charge. I mean, he made it. He made everything, so everything belongs to him. Mm-hmm. He's the guy, right? Okay, well, that follows. And if he says something, if he is then giving commands, then there are laws that we're obliged to obey. And so there's a grounding for morality, okay? And if we don't obey them, there are consequences. And so there is a justification for the idea of punishment mm-hmm. for those who do right and who don't do right, and for the need for mercy for all of us, and the possibility of forgiveness when mercy is offered. So what I'm saying is there are a whole bunch of things that kind of naturally follow from one thing, God, the kind of God that you and I are talking about. Mm-hmm, there are mm-hmm. different characterizations of divine beings, but we're not talking about that right now.
Right.
And so then there is the denial of that. If there is no God, and generally atheists are what are called materialists too. In other words, they don't just reject God, but everything in that non-physical immaterial realm. It doesn't right. exist. Their senses and science tell them about what's real, and that's where it ends as far as they're concerned. But then that has ramifications too, because there is no lawmaker then. And if there's no lawmaker, there is no laws. And by the way, if there are no laws, then there are no broken laws. And when I talk about laws here, I mean real laws, deep laws, laws that govern the universe, moral laws here, not just things that we pass and we can change them if we want, like local governments or something. Yeah. So if there are no laws, there are no broken laws. If there are no broken laws, there cannot be a problem of evil. So right. atheists must deny what seems to be the most salient detail of life, and that is that something is wrong with the world. Mm-hmm. And actually, more specifically, many will admit something's wrong with us, and we contribute to what's wrong with the world. Okay, so these are all ramifications. There are right. also, if you're an atheist, well, it's all physical things, molecules clashing in the universe. There is no evil. There is no good. There's no meaning. There's no purpose. There's nothing, as Richard Dawkins says, but blind, pitiless indifference. Okay, some people are going to get hurt. Some people aren't. That's just the way it is. Tough luck, too bad. That's right. what you're left with. So I think it's helpful for Christians to see that there's a kind of entailment relationship to mm-hmm. the big things and all the things that follow. One of the reasons this is important, Matthew, is because there's a lot of Christians that are questioning Christianity now, and they're wondering, well, maybe this isn't true. And the reason is they don't like some of the details. I don't like mm-hmm. hell. Okay, so I'm not going to believe in God. Okay, well, what that means is there not only is no punishment for people who do bad in the ultimate sense, you know, I can't believe he got murder. Away with that. He got away with murder. Well, that bothers us, right? Well, he's going to get away with it, all right? And there's not going to be any ultimate justice of any kind, because murder's not even wrong. That's what you're left with. Okay. Mm-hmm. And unless somebody's thinking about these things in terms of the whole worldview, this is where they're going to get caught by some of these details that bother them, or some non-Christian may make a big fuss about. So if I were to just focus on two things for your question, the resurrection of Christ and the existence of God, because so many other things follow from that. Incidentally, notice I did not say the authority of the Bible. And there's a reason I believe in inerrancy, okay? So I'm not a softie on that at all. I'm talking in practical terms and talking with other people. I make the case for the resurrection of Christ from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as historical documents, not as divinely inspired right. documents.
If we were to approach these as historians approach other historical documents.
Exactly right. Yeah, okay. And I think we could still make our case. And I approach God's existence not by quoting Bible verses, but by right. quoting obvious, what seemed to me to be obvious evidences of a supreme being governing the right. world.
That's really helpful. So you've talked, speaking about reasons that people might have, the big picture, you know, evidences for the existence of God, or reasons, the resurrection. You've talked to so many people in general, but also many young people over 50 university campuses. Do you find
actually that, it's over 80 now? Those
oh,
are old
okay,
stuff.
That's an old stuff.
I mean, that's no big deal. And plus, I'm in my 33rd year of radio now. So.
Oh my goodness! Wow, so. Wow! I was looking at an old bio.
yeah, that's right.
So
no worries.
So. Like I find in my own experience that people really resonate with wanting a meaning or a purpose in their lives. Yeah. So I think it was, I'm quoting from memory here, but Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor, I think he right. said, you know, ever more people have the means to live, but no meaning to live for.
Right.
And so do you find as you talk to people talking about reasons for faith or belief that hey, there's actually a purpose or a meaning in your life in the footsteps of Jesus, do you find that comes up as a compelling reason for people to explore, oh, my life could have meaning or purpose? Maybe I should look into that more.
Right. Well, I guess to be honest, I haven't really pursued that as aggressively as other means of making the case, but it's a very important thing. And there's in the latest edition of the book, the 10th anniversary edition, which now is okay. the only one that's available. It's got a big red, I don't have a copy here with right
I must have
right
the old circle, one because there's no big circle on it.
Yeah, at the top there it says 10th anniversary edition, but I have a chapter in there called Inside Out. And this is a tactic that trades on the truth that God has built certain things inside of every human being. The scripture says that we have eternity in our hearts. Others have referred to things mm-hmm. like a God-shaped vacuum. Augustine famously, our hearts are restless and they mm-hmm. and until they find their rest in thee, kind of thing. And so all of this is acknowledging that there is something about the human condition that hungers for deeper meaning. Right. Because, now this is what's key, because there is, the hunger is there because there is something to satisfy the hunger. Now, this is a concept from C.S. Lewis, but it's very obvious, okay? Mm-hmm. The human condition, excuse me, is to hunger for something deeper. The reason I pause on this right now, because I do think this is true, and when push comes to shove, in certain periods of people's lives, this becomes a very big factor, especially mm-hmm. later in life, okay? But I'm in a little conflict with a young atheist YouTuber. He's 27, and he did a critique of me that in front of 500,000 of his subscribers that I'll be responding to on my own radio show next week. But this is one thing that he pushed back on. He said, we don't need absolute meaning, objective meaning, transcendent meaning. I got plenty of meaning I make for my own life. I'm happy with the idea that there is no God, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's possible for people to find things that are meaningful to them in their lives that don't have transcendence to them, at least for a period of time. And frankly, if you have enough toys, you can do this for your whole life.
Yeah.
Enough distractions. But I do think that people who think deeply about these things find out something different. In fact, in this chapter, Inside Out, that I mentioned in the book, in the 10th anniversary edition book, which is the only book they're going to be able to get if they go online or whatever right. anymore. So it's there. I noticed that there was a difference between people, the way people responded to two deaths that happened in the same week, oh, maybe 10, 12 years ago. All right. Mother Teresa and Princess Di. They both died the same week, all right? And now, it might be in a younger audience. I don't know your audience, but they might not even know who these two people are. But Mother Teresa was a nun in Calcutta who spent her whole life devoted to the poor. And she's famous for that. And Princess Di was the current Prince of England. I don't know what they call him anymore, but the one on in accession to the throne of England, his wife that he divorced for someone else many years ago, and then she got killed in a car accident.
Yeah.
All right. It's tragic because people really like Princess Di. Wait a minute. Her death was tragic, but Mother Teresa's wasn't. These were two human beings that died. What was the difference? And well, Princess died before her time, quote unquote. She had an untimely death. Well, notice that when people say things like that, they are suggesting that a person's life is actually meant for something more. than just this early death. She didn't get to experience all that she could experience. That's tragic. Well, there's no way to make sense of that in an atheistic worldview, because it presumes that individual lives have purpose that go beyond the individual's own intentions. And a person who wants to commit suicide, would you try to talk them out of it? Yes. Why? On that view. Well, I don't want them to waste their life. How can they waste a life that has no purpose? Right. If their life gets purpose based on what they want to do, they want to off themselves. So why are you getting in the way of that? Okay. So this is part of the logical entailment of those particular views. Yeah. So I think this purpose element, this is called the existential problem, is a big deal, but people are not directly in touch with it in a meaningful way on a regular basis like they are the problem of evil. And so I'm going to go generally to the problem of evil to make my case more than to this existential issue, unless the person is in an existential crisis of meaning in their own life.
Right. I want to ask you two more things here. I want to respect your time, but a couple of key things I think are going to be super helpful for people. So you say that your goal is to win the person, not necessarily to win the argument. Because we're talking about, you know, we're talking about, okay, we're sharing ideas or this and that. Can you expand on this idea? Because I think we confuse the two. The goal is to win the person, not the argument.
Yeah, and this needs clarification, because it is not as if the argument, that is the substance of our point and the reasons for it, is irrelevant. It's very important.
Like, you want to make good arguments and true arguments.
Yes, we do. Arguments as opposed to quarrels. I'm not talking about argument as a synonym for a quarrel. We don't want quarrels. Paul says don't do that in 2 Timothy chapter 2. The Lord's bondservant should not be quarrelsome, but patient when wronged, okay? Yeah. But arguments are making a case. You make a claim and give evidence, reasons for it, okay? Right. And so that is important in our discussions. But for some of us, and look, I'm speaking autobiographically here. For some of us, what's most important is winning, being right, and showing the other person you're wrong and I'm right.
Look at how smart I am.
Look how smart I am. Yeah. And not being concerned for the consequences in the life of the other person about the larger issues, okay? In other words, believing, trusting in Christ and all of those things that we're supposed to be moving towards. So this idea of win the person, not the argument, is meant to put these two things in proper balance. We are using the argument for the purpose of winning a person. And if the manner in which we are using the argument is not helping us to win the person, then we have to adjust. Maybe that isn't going to be appealing to them. That isn't going to make a difference to them. We have to adjust our approach. And because the most important thing is not winning the argument, the most important thing is winning the person. That's the sense there. Arguments matter, but we want to make sure, and this is why the tactical game plan is so important. A big part of it is we're drawing the other person out. Paul says so that we know how to respond to each person. He says that in Colossians 4, so that we know how to respond to each person. And so that's a big part of what we're doing here.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
To the individual, yeah.
Yeah, the individual, and we're seeking the best for them. We want the best for them. And I appreciate how you put it in the book too, like when someone gets angry, it's like we lose.
Yes, that's right. Anybody gets angry, we lose, yeah.
It's like no one really like, oh, I'm really upset at you at all. Look at how smart you are, and now I believe you fully. Like, yeah, no, it's more complicated than that. Just as we kind of bring this to a close, is there anything that you want to share with people, maybe that was kind of on your mind, that as we think about the building blocks to apologetics that maybe hasn't been said yet, as people kind of think about their own game plan?
Well, we've been making reference to the book Tactics, and the key to that whole approach is to use questions to maneuver in conversation. I spent a lot of time talking about how to do that. But as I often end my talks, I'll say, if you get stuck in your conversations with someone, you don't know where to go, just remember one thing. Take a tip from Lieutenant Columbo, the TV star who used this technique so well. Always use questions. Mm-hmm. And so if you're stuck and you don't know what to do, ask a question.
Yeah.
That immediately throws the ball in the other person's court. Probably they're going to give you some information that will help, and it definitely will buy you some more time. So that's the thing I think I'd want to leave with them. And maybe I just add to that, that don't be surprised at the hostility from the world, and don't be surprised if you don't get everything you want this time around. That's what the culture is saying. You know, there used to be an old beer commercial that said, you only live once. Remember that? Budweiser. And so, but it was the same theme many years ago. It was the same theme that you see. I saw it on the TV commercials during the Super Bowl. You know, basically many various forms of you do you.
Right.
I think the commercial there was ended, grab for all the gusto you can get, which for them was their beer. But the point is, you know, this is the only life you have to live. You better make the most of it. And that's a lie. We live in this life for a different life. And that life is a whole lot longer than this one. It's eternal. It's not temporal.
Yeah. Wow. And that in and of itself is a source of hope. And you say one of the things you said there was, I didn't reference it earlier, I should have, but I just really appreciate how, and this is one of the personal takeaways from the book that I've just really resonated with me, is the putting the stone in the shoe. It's like you don't have to accomplish everything right away. It's just, if you put a stone in the shoe, meaning something that just kind of makes them, you know, like a stone in your shoe you need to kind of deal with. And so it's a thought in their mind about just going to take them to the next spot, or, what about this? Maybe this, if they leave thinking about something, then you've won.
Yeah, that goes back to the comment you made at the beginning of our conversation that you don't have to swing for the fences.
Right.
You don't even have to get on base. Just get in the batter's box. And that's the whole idea of that, just doing a little bit. And it's the whole concept of gardening versus harvesting that I develop in the book.
So everybody, the book is called Tactics. Here it is. This is not the 10th anniversary edition, but you can get that. And I'm going to put a link to that in there and a bunch of other things that Greg spoke about as well. Just as a final word, do you want to share anything that you're, any other projects that you're working on that you want people to know about?
Yeah, I actually am working on a sequel to the Tactics book, and it's really focusing on the third use of the tactic of the questioning, the game plan. I should say, the first is to gather information. The second is to reverse the burden of proof. You mentioned that. And the third step is to make a point with your questions, all with questions. Okay. So of course, if you're going to make a point, you have to know the point you're going to make. I gave you one illustration of it there as we were talking about a role play that I just did about the science and religion kind of issue, using questions, but I'm making the point there about sciences and religion aren't enemies, but, I use questions to do that. Well, I'm going to have a whole book about that. And the book's working title is Street Smarts. And the subtitle is Using Questions to Answer Christianity's Toughest Challenges. So I am going to deal with atheism. I'm going to show you here are the problems with it and all the weak points. But now you know this. How do you employ that? You employ it by using questions, and then I'm going to have a sample dialogues of questions that will lead into the points that I've just described as weaknesses of atheism that will prompt people to have more productive conversations. So that's the idea of that book. It's going to be out the end of the year. My due date is racing towards me, and it terrifies me right now, so I have to get to work on it, but that's just the life of a writer.
You're under the gun. Well, we look forward to that very much. Street Smarts. Street Smarts. That is great. Thank you. I just want to end with just these two quotes that just came to mind in preparation for this. Augustine, if I am weighed down by one great sorrow, it is sorrow over Christians, over my brothers who enter the church in their bodies but leave their hearts outside. And I think we could substitute minds for that.
Yes, sure.
And then Alistair McGrath, no one can live on borrowed answers. And I think that is so good. And I think you today have given us, Greg, so many great things to think about using our minds, about not thinking about someone else's answers, but our own as we put these together. So thanks so much for your witness in your life and just all that you do.
Well, I had a great time with you, Matthew, and I'd love to have a chat again.